The Bradley commander heard scattered firing and guessed that the Russians had pulled back partway, maybe all the way to their own Kazern. It made sense. Both sides' tanks had been badly mauled, and it was now a battle for infantrymen and their fighting vehicles. Foot soldiers, he knew, were smarter than tankers. It came from wearing a shirt instead of a foot of iron. Vulnerability made you think. He changed position yet again. It was odd how this worked, though he'd practiced the maneuver often enough. The vehicle ran close to a corner, and a man would dismount to peer around it. "Nothing, Sarge. It's all..." "Wait! Something moving. About 2 miles down the street." The soldier raised a pair of glasses. "BDRM. The missile kind." "Okay," the sergeant thought. "That'll be the reconnaissance element for the next wave." His job was entirely straightforward. Reconnaissance was a two-part job. His job was both to find the enemy and to prevent the enemy from finding things. "Another one!" "Get ready to move. Traverse right. Targets to the right," he added for the gunner. "Ready, Sarge." "Go!" The Bradley's armored body rocked backwards as a vehicle leaped into the intersection. The gunner brought his turret around. It looked like a small bore shooting gallery. There were two BDRM armored scout cars heading straight toward them. The gunner engaged the leader, exploding the anti-tank missile launcher on top. The BDRM veered to the left and rammed some parked cars. Already the gunner shifted fire to the second, which jerked right to evade, but the street was too narrow for that. The chain gun was a nice compromise between a machine gun and a cannon. The gunner was able to walk his tracers into the target and had the satisfaction of watching it explode. But... "Back fast! Now!" the sergeant screamed into the intercom. There had been a third BDRM back there. The Bradley retreated the way it had come. Barely had it gotten behind the buildings when a missile streaked down the street it had crossed, trailing a thin wire behind it. The missile exploded a few hundred meters away. "Time to leave. Turn us around," the track commander said. Then he activated his radio. "This is Delta 3-3. We have contact with reconnaissance vehicles. Two destroyed, but the third one spotted us. We got more friends coming in, sir." "General, we've pushed them back across the line. I can hold out against what's here, but if more gets into us, we're screwed," Colonel Long said. "Sir, we need help here." "Okay, I'll have some air to you in 10 minutes. Fast movers on the way now." "That's a start, but I need more than that, sir."
Sackyer turned to his operations officer.
"What's ready?"
"Second of the 11th Cav, sir. They're moving out of their Kazern right now."
"What's between them and Berlin?"
"Russians? Not much. If they move fast..."
"Move them out."
Sackyer walked back to his desk and lifted the phone for Washington.
"Yes, what is it?" Fowler asked.
"Sir, it appears that the Russians are bringing reinforcements into Berlin. I have just ordered the 2nd Squadron, 11th Armored Cav, to move toward Berlin to reinforce. I also have aircraft heading in now to assess the situation."
"Do you have any idea what they're up to?"
"None, sir. It makes no damn sense at all, but we still have people being killed."
"What are the Russians telling you, Mr. President?"
"They're asking why we attacked them, General."
"Are they nuts?
Or is it something else?" Sackyer wondered. "Something really frightening."
"General."
It was a woman's voice. Probably that Elliot woman, Sackyer thought. "I want to be very clear on this. Are you sure that the Soviets initiated the attack?"
"Yes, ma'am," Sackyer replied heatedly. "The commander of the Berlin Brigade is probably dead. The XO is Lieutenant Colonel Edward Long. I know the kid. He's good. He says the Russians opened fire on the brigade without warning while they were responding to the alert you sent out from D.C. They didn't even have their tubes loaded. I repeat, ma'am, the Russians are the ones who started shooting, and that's definite. Now, do I have your permission to reinforce?"
"What happens if you don't?" Fowler asked.
"In that case, Mr. President, you have about 5,000 letters to write."
"Look. Okay, send in the reinforcements. Tell Berlin to take no offensive action. We're trying to get things settled down."
"I wish you luck, Mr. President. But right now,
I have a command to run.
President Narmanov, we have received word from Europe that a Soviet tank regiment launched an attack on our Berlin brigade without warning. I just talked to our commander and he confirms that this is true. What is happening? Why did your troops attack our troops?
Have we heard anything from Berlin yet? Narmanov asked.
The defense minister shook his head.
No. The lead reconnaissance elements should just be getting in now. Radio communications are a disaster. Our VHF radios work poorly in cities because they are line of sight only. What we're getting is fragmented, mainly tactical communications between subunit commanders. We have not established contact with the regimental commander. He may be dead.
After all, defense pointed out, the Americans like to go after commanders first.
So we really do not know what is going on?
No, but I am certain that no Soviet commander would open fire on Americans without just cause.
Golovko closed his eyes and swore under his breath. Now the defense minister was showing the strain.
Sergei Nikolaevich, Narmanov asked.
We have nothing more to report from KGB. You may expect that all of the American land-based missiles are fully on alert, as are all their submarine missiles at sea. We estimate that the American missile submarines in port will all have sortied in a matter of hours.
And our missile submarines?
One is leaving the dock now. The rest are preparing to do so. It will take most of the day to get them all out.
Why are we so slow? Narmanov demanded.
The Americans have two complete crews for their boats. We have only one. It's simply easier for them to surge them out this way.
So you are telling me that their strategic forces are totally ready, or nearly so, and ours are not?
All of our land-based rockets are fully prepared.
President Narmanov, your reply to the Americans?
What do I say now? Andrei Ilyich asked.
A colonel entered the room.
Report from Berlin.
He handed it to the defense minister.
The Americans are in the eastern part of the city. The first wave of scout cars was taken under fire. Four vehicles, the officer commanding, was killed in one of them. We've returned fire and gotten two American vehicles. No contact as yet with our regiment.
The defense minister looked at the other one.
Carrier Kuznetsov reports that he launched a two-plane patrol. They detected a rescue radio signal and went to investigate. Contact was then lost. They have an American carrier battle group 400 kilometers away and request instructions.
What does that mean?
The defense minister checked the times on the second dispatch.
If our planes are not back by now, they are nearly out of fuel. We must assume they were lost, cause unknown. But the close proximity of the American carrier is troubling.
What the hell are they doing?
President Fowler, I am certain that no Soviet commander would attack American troops without orders, and there were no such orders. We have sent additional troops into Berlin to investigate, and they were attacked by your forces in the eastern part of the city, well away from your encampment.
What are you doing?
What the hell is he talking about?
What am I doing? What the hell is he doing?
Fowler growled. A light came on. It was the CIA. The president pushed the button, adding a new line to his conference call.
That depends on who he is, Elliot warned.
Yes, what is it?
Mr. President, what we have here is simple confusion. Ryan? We don't want analysis, we want information. Do you have any? Liz shouted. The Soviets are sortieing their ships out of the Northern Fleet ports. One missile submarine is supposed to be heading out.
So their land-based missiles are fully alerted?
Correct.
And they're adding to their submarine missile force also?
Yes, Mr. President.
Do you have any good news?
Sir, the news is that there is no real news right now, and you're...
Listen, Ryan, one last time. I want information from you and nothing else. You brought me that Kadyshev stuff, and now you're saying it was all wrong. So why should I believe you now? Sir, when I gave it to you, I told you it was not confirmed.
I think we may have confirmation now, Liz pointed out. General Borstein, if they're fully online, what exactly is the threat?
The fastest thing they can get to us is an ICBM. Figure one regiment of SS-18s targeted on the Washington area, and most of the others targeted on our missile fields in the Dakotas, plus the sub-bases at Charleston, Kings Bay, Bangor, and the rest. Warning time will be 25 minutes.
And we will be targets here? Liz asked.
That is a reasonable assumption, Dr. Elliot.
So they will try to use SS-18s to finish what the first weapon missed?
If that was their work, yes.
General Fremont, how far out is the backup kneecap?
Dr. Elliot, it took off about 10 minutes ago. It'll be at Hagerstown in 95 minutes. They have some good tailwinds.
Sinksack regretted that addition almost at once. So if they are thinking about an attack and they launch it within the next hour and a half, we're dead here?
Yes. Elizabeth, it's our job to prevent that, remember?
Fowler said quietly. The National Security Advisor looked over at the President. Her face might have been made of glass, so brittle it looked. It wasn't supposed to be like this. She was the chief advisor to the most powerful man in the world, in a place of ultimate safety, guarded by dedicated servants. But less than 30 minutes from the time some faceless, nameless Russian made a decision, perhaps one already made, she'd be dead. Dead. A few ashes in the wind, certainly no more than that. Everything she'd worked for, all the books and classes and seminars, would have ended in a blinding, annihilating flash.
Robert, we don't even know who we're talking to, she said in an uneven voice.
Back to their message, Mr. President, General Fremont said. Additional troops to investigate. Sir, that sounds like reinforcements.
A rookie fireman found the first survivor, crawling up the concrete ramp from the basement loading dock. It was amazing he'd made it. His hands had second-degree burns, and the crawl had ground bits of glass and concrete and Lord knew what into his injuries. The firefighter lifted the man. It was a cop, and carried him off to the evacuation point. The two remaining fire engines sprayed both men with water. Then they were ordered to strip, and they were hosed again. The police officer was semi-conscious, but tore a sheet of paper off the clipboard he'd been holding, and all during the ambulance ride he was trying to tell the fireman something, but the firefighter was too cold, too tired, and much too scared to pay attention. He'd done his job, and might have lost his life in the process. It was altogether too much for a 20-year-old, who simply stared at the wet floor of the ambulance and shivered inside his blanket. The entranceway had been topped with a pre-stressed concrete lintel. That had been shattered by the blast, with one piece blocking the way in. A soldier from the tank snaked a cable from the turret-mounted winch around the largest of the remaining blocks. As he did this, Chief Callahan kept staring at his watch. It was too late to stop now in any case. He had to see this through if he died in the process. The cable went taut, pulling the concrete fragment clear. Miraculously, the remainder of the entranceway did not collapse. Callahan led the way through the rubbled opening, with Colonel Lyle behind him. The emergency lights were on, and it seemed that every sprinkler head had gone off. This part of the stadium was where the main came into the structure, Callahan remembered, and that explained the falling water. There were other sounds, the kind that came from people. Callahan went into a men's room and found two women, both sitting in the water, both of their coats sprinkled with their own vomit.
"Get him out of here!" he shouted to his men. "Go both ways. Give it a quick check and get back here fast as you can."
Callahan checked all the toilet stalls. They were unoccupied. Another look at the room showed nothing else. They'd come all this way for two women in the wrong bathroom. Just two. The chief looked at Colonel Lyle, but there really wasn't anything to say. Both men walked out into the concourse. It took Callahan a moment to realize it, even though it was right there, an entrance to the stadium's lower level. Whereas only a short time before the view would have been of the stadium's south side and the roof, what he now saw was the mountains, still outlined in orange by a distant setting sun. The opening called to him, and as though in a trance, he walked up the ramp. It was a scene from hell. Somehow this section had been shielded one way or another from the blast, but not the thermal pulse. There were perhaps 300 seats, still largely intact, still with people in them. What had once been people. They were burned black, charcoal like overdone meat, worse than any fire victim he'd ever seen in nearly 30 years of fighting fires. At least 300, still sitting there, looking at where the field had been. "Come on, Chief," Colonel Lyle said, pulling him away. The man collapsed, and Lyle saw him vomiting inside his gas mask. The Colonel got it off him and pulled him clear. "Time to leave. It's all over here. You've done your job." It turned out that 4 more people were still alive. The firemen loaded them on the engine deck of the tank, which drove off at once to the evacuation point. The remaining firefighters there washed everything off and departed too. Perhaps the only good luck of the day, Larry Parsons thought, was the snow cover. It had attenuated the thermal damage to the adjacent buildings. Instead of hundreds of house fires, there were only a few. Better, the afternoon sun of the previous day had been just intense enough to form a crust on the yards and roofs around the stadium. Parsons was looking for material on that crust. He and his men searched with scintillometers. The almost incredible fact of the matter was that while a nuclear bomb converted much of its mass into energy, the total mass lost in the process was minuscule. Aside from that, matter is very hard to destroy, and he was searching for residue from the device. This was easier than one might have thought. The material was dark, on a flat white surface, and it was also highly radioactive. He had a choice of 6 very hot spots, 2 miles downrange of the stadium. Parsons had taken the hottest. Dressed in his lead-coated protective suit, he was trudging across a snow-covered lawn. Probably an elderly couple, he thought. No kids had built a snowman or lain down to make angels. The rippling sound of the counter grew larger. There. The residue was hardly larger in size than dust particles, but there were many of them, probably pulverized gravel and paving material from the parking lot, Parsons thought. If he were very lucky, it had been sucked up through the center of the fireball, and bomb residue had affixed itself to it. If he were lucky. Parsons scooped up a trowel's worth and slid it into a plastic bag. This he tossed to his teammate, who dropped the bag into a lead bucket.
"Very hot stuff, Larry."
"I know. Let me get one more." He scooped up another sample and bagged it as well. Then he lifted his radio.
"Parsons here. You got anything?"
"Yeah, 3 nice ones, Larry. Enough, I think, for an assay."
"Meet me at the chopper."
"On the way." Parsons and his partner walked off, ignoring the wide eyes watching from behind windows. Those people were not his concern for the moment. Thank God, he thought, that they hadn't bothered him with questions. The helicopter sat in the middle of a street, its rotor still turning.
"Where to?" Andy Bowler asked.
"We're going to the command center. Shopping center. Should be nice and cold there. You take the samples back and run them through the spectrometer."
"You should come along."
"Can't," Parsons said with a shake of the head. "I have to call into D.C.
This isn't what they told us. Somebody goofed, and I gotta tell them. Have to use a landline for that."
The conference room had at least 40 phone lines routed into it, one of which was Ryan's direct line. The electronic warble caught his attention. Jack pushed the flashing button and lifted the receiver.
"Ryan."
"Jack."
"What's going on?" Kathy Ryan asked her husband. There was alarm, but not panic in her voice.
"What do you mean?"
"The local TV station says an atomic bomb went off in Denver."
"Is there a war, Jack?"
"Kathy, I can't." "No, honey, there's no war going on, okay?"
"Jack, they showed a picture."
Is there anything I need to know?
You know almost everything I know. Something happened. We don't know what exactly, and we're trying to find out. The president's at Camp David with the National Security Advisor, and...
Elliot?
Yes. They're talking to the Russians right now. Honey, I have work to do.
Should I take the children somewhere?
The proper thing, and the honorable and dramatic thing, Jack told himself, was to tell his wife to stay home, that they had to share the risks with everybody else. But the fact was there was no place of safety that he knew. Ryan looked out the window, wondering what the hell he should say. No. Liz Elliott is advising the president? That's right. Jack? She's a small, weak person. Maybe she's smart, but inside she's weak. I know. Kathy, I really have things to do here.
Love you.
And I love you too, babe. Bye. Jack replaced the receiver. The word's out, he announced. Pictures and all.
Jack?
It was the senior duty officer. AP just sent out a flash. Shooting in Berlin between U.S. and Soviet forces. Reuters is reporting the explosion in Denver. Ryan got on the phone to Murray. You have the wire services?
Jack, I knew this wouldn't work.
What do you mean? The president told us to shut the networks down. I guess we goofed somewhere.
Super.
You should have refused that one, Dan.
I tried, okay?
There were just too many redundancies, too many nodes. Two satellites serving the United States were still up and operating, and so was nearly all of the microwave repeater system that had preceded them. The networks didn't merely run out of New York and Atlanta. NBC's Los Angeles Bureau, after a surreptitious call from Rockefeller Center, took over for that network. CBS and ABC accomplished the same out of Washington and Chicago, respectively. The irate reporters also let the public know that FBI agents were holding hostage the network news headquarters people in the most heinous abuse yet of the First Amendment. ABC was outraged that its crew had been killed, but that was a small thing compared to the scope of the story. The proverbial cat was out of the bag, and phone lines at the White House press office lit up. Many reporters had the direct number to Camp David as well. There was no statement from the president. That only made things worse. The CBS affiliate in Omaha, Nebraska, had only to drive past SAC headquarters to note the beefed-up guard force and the empty flight line. Those pictures would be on nationwide in a matter of minutes, but it was the local news teams who did the best and the worst work. There is scarcely a city or town in America that lacks a National Guard armory or a base for reservists. Concealing the activity at all of them was tantamount to concealing a sunrise, and the wire service printers reported activity everywhere. All that was needed to punctuate those reports was the few minutes of tape from KOLD in Denver, running almost continuously now, to explain what was going on and why. The phones at the Aurora Presbyterian were all being used. Parsons knew that he could have forced his way onto one, but it was easier to run across the street to a largely deserted shopping center. He found an FBI agent there, wearing a blue raid jacket that proclaimed his identity in large block letters. "You the guy from the stadium?" Parsons' headgear was gone, but he still wore the metallic coat and pants.
"Yeah.
I need a phone.
Save your quarters."
They were standing outside a men's clothing store. The door had alarm tape on it, but looked cheap. The agent pulled out his service pistol and fired 5 rounds, shattering the glass.
"After you, pal."
Parsons ran to the counter and lifted the store phone, dialing his headquarters in Washington. Nothing happened.
"Where are you calling?"
"D.C.
The long-distance lines are down."
"What do you mean?
The phone company shouldn't be hurt from this."
"We did it.
Orders from Washington," the agent explained.
"What fucking idiot ordered that?"
"The president."
"Outstanding. I gotta get a call out."
"Wait." The agent took the phone and called his own office. "Hoskins, this is Larry Parsons, Nest team leader. Can you relay something to Washington?"
"Sure.
The bomb was a ground burst, less than 15 kilotons. We have samples of the residue, and it's on the way to Rocky Flats for spectroscopy. You know how to get that out?
Yes, I can do that.
Okay. Parsons hung up.
You have pieces from the bomb? The FBI agent asked incredulously.
Sounds crazy, doesn't it?
That's what fallout is. Bomb residue that gets attached to dirt particles.
So what?
So we can figure out a lot from that.
Come on, he told the agent. Both men ran back across the street toward the hospital. An FBI agent, Parsons decided, was a useful fellow to have around.
Jack got something from Denver, came in through Walt Hoskins. The bomb was a ground burst, 15 or so kilotons. The Nest guys have residue and they're going to test it.
Ryan took his notes. Casualty count?
Didn't say.
15 kilotons, the S&T man observed.
Low for what the satellites said, but possible.
Still, too goddamn big for an IND.
The F-16C wasn't exactly ideal for this mission, but it was fast. Four had left Ramstein only 20 minutes earlier. Put aloft by the initial DEFCON 3 alert, they'd come east to what they still referred to as the inner German border. They'd not even arrived there when new orders had sent them toward the southern end of Berlin to get a look at what was happening at the Berlin Brigade's caserne. Four F-15s from Bitburg joined for top cover. All eight USAF fighters were loaded for air-to-air missions only, with two extra fuel tanks each in the place of bombs for the F-16s and conformal fuel cells for the Eagles. From 10,000 feet, they could see the flashes and explosion on the ground. The flight of four broke into two elements of two each and went down for a closer look while the Eagles orbited overhead. The problem, it was later decided, was twofold. First, the pilots were simply too surprised at the turn of events to consider all the possibilities. Adding to this was the fact that American aircraft losses over Iraq had been so minor as to make the pilots forget that this was a different place. The Russian tank regiment had both SA-8 and SA-11 missiles, plus the normal complement of Shilka 23mm flak vehicles. The anti-air company commander had waited for this moment, not illuminating his radars, playing it smart, as the Iraqis had singularly failed to do. He waited until the American aircraft were under 1,000 meters before giving his order. Barely had their threat receivers come on when a swarm of missiles rose from the eastern edge of the Russian encampment. The Eagles, high up, had a much better chance at evasion. The F-16 fighting Falcons, descending right into the SAM trap, had almost none. Two were blotted out in a matter of seconds. The second pair dodged the first wave of SAMs, but one was caught in the frag pattern of a second wave, SA-11, it almost, but not quite, evaded. That pilot ejected successfully, but died when he landed too hard on the roof of an apartment building. The fourth F-16 escaped by skimming the rooftops and screaming west on full burner. Two of the Eagles joined him. A total of five American aircraft crashed into the city. Only one of the pilots lived. The escaping aircraft radioed the news to Commander U.S. Air Forces Europe at Ramstein. Already he had 12 F-16s arming up with heavy ordnance. The next wave would be different.
President Narmanov, we sent some aircraft into Berlin to investigate the situation there. They were shot down without warning by Soviet missiles. Why was this done?
What does this mean?
Shot down without warning.
There's a battle underway, and that's why the aircraft were sent there. The regiment has anti-aircraft troops, the defense minister explained. They only have short-range, low-altitude rockets. If the Americans were just looking from a safe height, 10,000 meters, we couldn't even have touched them. They must have been lower, probably trying to support their troops with an air attack. That's the only way we could have gotten them.
But we have no information.
No, we have not established contact yet.
We will not answer this one.
That is a mistake, Golovko said. This situation is dangerous enough already, Narmanov said angrily. We do not know what is going on there. How can I respond when he claims to have information which I do not?
If you do not respond, you appear to admit the incident.
We admit nothing, the defense minister shouted. We could not even have done this unless they were attacking us, and we don't know whether it really happened or not.
So tell them that, Golovko suggested.
Perhaps if they understand that we are as confused as they will also understand that... But they won't understand, and they won't believe. They've already accused us of launching this attack, and they won't believe that we have no control over the area.
Narmanov retreated to a corner table and poured himself a cup of tea, while the intelligence and defense advisors traded... arguments? Was that the right word? The Soviet president looked up at the ceiling. This command center dated back to Stalin. A spur off one of the Moscow subway lines built by Lazar Kaganovich, Stalin's pet Jewish anti-Semite and his most trusted henchman. It was fully 100 meters down. But now his people told him that it was not truly a place of safety after all.
What was Fowler thinking? Narmanov asked himself. The man was undoubtedly shaken by the murder of so many American citizens. But how could it be possible that he was thinking that the Soviets were responsible? And what was actually happening? A battle in Berlin? A possible clash between naval forces in the Mediterranean? All unrelated. Or were they? Did it matter?
Narmanov stared at a picture on the wall and realized that no, it did not matter. He and Fowler were both politicians for whom appearances had more weight than reality, and perceptions more importance than facts. The American had lied to him in Rome over a trivial matter. Was he lying now? If he were, then none of the past 10 years of progress mattered at all, did they? It had all been for nothing.
How do wars begin?
Narmanov asked himself quietly in the corner. In history, wars of conquest were started by strong men who wished to grow stronger still. But the time for men of imperial ambition had passed. The last such criminal had died not so long before. All that had changed in the 20th century. The First World War had been started. How? A tubercular assassin had killed a buffoon so unloved that his own family had ignored the funeral. An overbearing diplomatic note had prompted Tsar Nikolai II to leap to the defense of people he hadn't loved. And then the timetables had begun. Nikolai had the last chance, Narmanov remembered. The last of the czars had held in his hand the chance to stop it all, but hadn't. If only he'd known what his decision for war would mean, he might have found the strength to stop it. But in his fear and his weakness, he'd signed the mobilization order that had ended one age and begun another. That war had begun because small, frightened men feared war less than showing weakness.
Fowler is such a man, Narmanov told himself. Proud, arrogant, a man who lied in a small thing lest I think less of him. He will be angered by the deaths. He will fear additional deaths, but he will fear displaying weakness even more. My country is at the mercy of such a man.
It was an elegant trap Narmanov was in. The irony of it might have evoked a tight, bitter smile, but instead the Soviet president set down his tea, for his stomach would take no more hot, bitter liquid. He could not afford to show weakness either, could he? That would only encourage Fowler to yet more irrationality. Part of Andrei Ilyich Narmanov asked if what he thought of Jonathan Robert Fowler might also apply to himself. But he had to reply. To do nothing would display weakness, wouldn't it?
No answer? Fowler asked the chief yeoman.
No, sir, nothing yet.
Arantxa's eyes were locked on the computer screen.
My God, the president muttered. All those people dead.
And I could have been one of them, Liz Elliott thought, the idea coming back to her like waves on a beach, crashing in, ebbing away, only to crash back again.
Someone wanted to kill us, and I am part of that us. And we don't know who
or why.
We can't let this go any farther.
We don't even know what we are trying to stop. Who is doing this? Why are they doing it?
Liz looked over at the clock and calculated the time to the arrival of the kneecap aircraft.
We should have gone out on the first one. Why didn't we think to have it fly to Hagerstown to pick us up? We're stuck here in a perfect target, and if they want to kill us, this time they'll get us, won't they? How can we stop it? Liz asked.
He's not even answering us. Sea Devil 1-3, a P-3C Orion anti-submarine aircraft out of Kodiak Naval Air Station, was buffeting through the winds at low altitude, about 500 feet. It laid the first line of 10 DIFAR sonar buoys 10 miles southwest of Maine's position. In the back, the sonar operators were strapped tightly into their high-backed seats, most with a vomit bag close by as they tried to make sense of their displays. It took several minutes for things to firm up.
Christ, that's my boat, Jim Roselli said.
He dialed Banger and asked for Commodore Mancuso.
Bart, what gives?
Maine reported a collision, shaft and screw damage. There's a P-3 riding shotgun on her right now, and we have Omaha heading toward her flat out. That's the good news. The bad news is that Maine was tracking an Akula at the time.
She was what?
Harry sold me and Op 02 on the idea, Jim. Too late to worry about it now. It should be okay. The Akula was way off. You heard what Harry did to Omaha last year, right?
Yeah.
I thought he stripped a gear. Look, it should be easy. I'm surging my boats right now, Jim. Unless you need me for something else, I'm kinda busy.
Right.
Roselli hung up.
What gives?
Rocky Barnes asked.
Roselli handed over the message.
My old sub, disabled in the Gulf of Alaska, and there's a Russian prowling around.
Hey, they're quiet, right?
You told me that. The Russians don't even know where they are.
Yeah.
Cheer up, Jim. I probably knew some of those F-16 drivers who got snuffed over Berlin.
Where the hell is Wilkes? He should have been here by now, Roselli said. He's got a good car.
No telling, man.
What the fuck is going on?
I don't know, Rocky.
We've got a long one coming in, Chief Arantxa said. Here it comes.
President Fowler, we have no information from Berlin on the matter to which you refer. Communications have broken down. My orders have gone out to our troops, and if they have gotten them, then they will take no action except in self-defense. Perhaps they felt themselves to be under attack by your aircraft and acted to defend themselves. In any case, we are trying even now to reestablish contact with the troops, but our first attempt to reach them was stopped by American troops who were well outside their camp. You accuse us of having opened fire, yet I have told you that our forces have no such orders, and the only definite word we have tells us that your forces were well into our zone of the city when they struck. Mr. President, I cannot reconcile your words with the facts we have. I make no accusation, but I know of nothing more that I can say to assure you that Soviet forces have taken no action whatever against American forces. You have told us that your alerting of your forces is defensive only, but we have indications that your strategic forces are in a very high state of alert. You say you have no reason to believe that we are to blame for this infamy, yet your most alert forces are those arrayed against my country. What do you wish me to think? You ask for proof of our good intentions, but all of your actions appear to lack them.
He's blustering, Liz Elliott observed at once. Whoever it is over there is rattled.
Good. We may get the upper hand here yet.
Good, Sinksack asked.
You realize that this frightened person you're talking about has a whole lot of missiles pointing at us.
I don't read it that way, Dr. Elliott. I think we have an angry man here. He's thrown our inquiries right back in our face.
What do you mean, General?
He says he knows we're alerted,
Okay, that's no surprise, but he also says that those weapons are pointed at him. He's accusing us of threatening him now. With nukes, Mr. President. That matters a hell of a lot more than the pissant business in Berlin.
I agree, General Borstein added. He's trying to bluster us, sir. We asked about a couple of lost airplanes, and we get all this tossed back at us.
Fowler punched up CIA again.
Ryan, you got the latest one?
Yes, sir.
What do you make of Narmanov's mental state?
Sir, he's a little angry right now, and also very concerned about our defensive posture. He's trying to find a way out of this.
I don't read it that way. He's rattled.
Well, who the hell isn't? Jack asked.
Of course he's rattled, the same as everyone else.
Look, Ryan, we are in control up here.
I never said otherwise, Liz, Jack replied, biting off what he really thought. This is a grave situation, and he's as concerned as we are. He's trying to figure out what's happening the same as everyone else. The problem is nobody really knows anything.
Well, whose fault is that?
That is your job, isn't it? Fowler asked testily.
Yes, Mr. President, and we're working on it. A lot of people are.
Robert, does this sound like Narmanov? You've met the man. You've spent time with him.
Elizabeth, I just don't know.
It's the only thing that makes sense.
Liz, who says that any of this has to make sense? Ryan asked.
This weapon was a big one, right, General Borstein?
That's what our instruments tell us, yes.
Who has bombs that large?
Us, the Russians, the Brits, the French. Maybe the Chinese have weapons like this, but we don't think so. Theirs are big and clunky. Israel has warheads in this range. That's it. India, Pakistan, South Africa all probably have fission weapons, but not large enough for this.
Ryan, is that correct information? Elliot asked.
Yes, it is.
So if it wasn't Britain, France, or Israel, then who the hell was it? God damn it, Liz, we don't know, okay? We do not know, and this isn't a fucking Sherlock Holmes mystery. Eliminating who it wasn't doesn't tell us who it was. You can't convert the absence of information into a conclusion.
Does CIA know everybody who has weapons of this type? Fowler asked.
Yes, sir, we think we do.
How confident are you in that?
Until today, I would have bet my life on it.
So again, you are not telling me the truth, are you? Fowler observed coldly.
Jack stood from his chair.
Sir, you may be the President of the United States, but don't you ever accuse me of lying again. My wife just called here to ask if she should take the kids somewhere, and if you think I'd be so goddamn dumb as to play games at a time like this, you, sir, are the one who needs help.
Thank you, Ryan. That will be all.
The line clicked off.
Jesus,
the senior duty officer observed. Jack looked around the room for a wastebasket. He just made it in time. Ryan fell to his knees and vomited into it. He reached for a can of Coke and washed his mouth out, spitting back into the basket. No one spoke until he rose.
They just don't understand,
Jack said quietly. He stretched, then lit a cigarette.
They just don't understand. You see, this is all very simple. There is a difference between not knowing anything and understanding that you don't know.
We have a crisis, and all the players are reverting to type. The president is thinking like a lawyer, trying to be cool, doing what he knows how to do, running down the evidence and trying to make a case, interrogating the witnesses, trying to reduce everything, playing that game. Liz is fixed on the fact that she might have been blown up. Can't set that aside.
Well,
Ryan shrugged. I guess I can understand that. I've been there too. She's a political scientist looking for a theoretical model. She's feeding that to the president. She has a real elegant model, but it's based on crap, isn't it, Ben?
You left out something, Jack, Goodley pointed out.
Ryan shook his head. No, Ben, I just haven't gotten there yet. Because I can't control my fucking temper, they won't listen to me now.
I should have known. I had my warning. I even saw it coming.
But I let my temper get the best of me again. And you know the funny part? If it wasn't for me, Fowler would still be in Columbus, Ohio, and Elliot would be teaching shiny young faces at Bennington. Jack walked to the window again. It was dark outside, and the lighted room made it into a mirror.
What are you talking about?
That, gentlemen, is a secret. Maybe that's what they'll put on the stone. Here lies John Patrick Ryan. He tried to do the right thing, and look what happened. I wonder if Kathy and the kids will make it.
Come on. It's not that bad, the senior duty officer observed, but all the others in the room felt the chill.
Jack turned. Isn't it? Don't you see where this is heading? They're not listening to anybody. They're not listening. They might listen to Dennis Bunker or Brent Talbot, but they're both air pollution, little bits of fallout somewhere over Colorado. I'm the closest thing in town to an advisor right now, and I got myself tossed out.
Chapter 41, The Field of Camlin. The Admiral Lunan was going too fast for safety. Captain Dubunin knew that, but chances like this did not come along often. This was, in fact, the first, and the captain wondered if it might also be the last. Why were the Americans on a full-blown nuclear alert? Yes, of course, a possible nuclear explosion in their country was a grave matter, but could they be so mad as to assume that a Soviet had done such a thing?
Get me a polar projection chart, he said to a quartermaster.
Dubunin knew what he would see, but it wasn't a time for remembrance, it was a time for hard facts. The meter square sheet of hard paper was on the table a moment later. Dubunin took a pair of dividers and walked them from Maine's estimated position to Moscow and to the strategic rocket fields in the central part of his country.
Yes.
It could hardly be more clear, could it?
What is it, Captain? The Starpom asked.
USS Maine, according to our intelligence estimates, is in the northernmost patrol sector of the missile submarines based at Bangor. That makes good sense, doesn't it?
Yes, Captain.
Based on what little we know of their patrol patterns.
She carries the D-5 rocket, 24 of them, 8 or so warheads per rocket.
He paused. There had been a time when he'd been able to do such calculations in his head instantly.
192, Captain, the executive officer said for him.
Correct, thank you. That includes nearly all of our SS-18s, less those being deactivated by treaty, and the CEP accuracy of the D-5 makes it likely that those 192 warheads will destroy roughly 160 of their targets, which in turn accounts for more than a fifth of our total warhead count, and our most accurate warheads at that.
Remarkable, isn't it? Dubunin asked quietly.
You really think they're that good? The Americans demonstrated their marksmanship ability over Iraq, didn't they? I, for one, have never doubted the quality of their weapons.
Captain, we know that the American D-5 submarine rockets are the most likely first-strike tool.
Continue the thought.
The Starpom looked at the chart.
Of course. This is the closest one.
Indeed. USS Maine is the point of the lance aimed at our country.
Dubunin tapped the chart with his dividers.
If the Americans launch an attack, the first rockets will fly from this point, and 19 minutes after that, they will hit. I wonder if our comrades in the strategic rocket forces can respond that quickly.
But, Captain,
what can we do about this? The executive officer asked dubiously.
Dubunin pulled the chart off the table and slid it back into its open drawer.
Nothing. Not a thing. We cannot attack preemptively without orders or grave provocation, can we? According to our best intelligence, he can launch his rockets at intervals of 15 seconds, probably less, really. The manual becomes less important in war, doesn't it?
say 4 minutes from the first to the last. You have to do a ladder north strike pattern to avoid warhead fratricide. That doesn't matter if you examine the physics of the event. I looked at that while I was at Froon's, you know. Since our rockets are liquid-fueled, they cannot launch while the attack is underway. Even if their electronic components can withstand the electromagnetic effects, they are too fragile structurally to tolerate the physical forces. So unless we can launch with confidence before the enemy warheads fall, our tactics are to ride it out and launch a few minutes later. For our part here, if he can launch in 4 minutes, that means we have to be within 6,000 meters, hear the first launch transient, and fire our own torpedo immediately to have any hope of stopping him from firing his last rocket, don't we?
A difficult task. The captain shook his head. An impossible task. The only thing that makes sense is for us to eliminate him before he receives his launch order. But we cannot do that without orders, and we have no such orders. So what do we do? Not very much we can do.
Dubinin leaned over the chart table.
Let's assume that he's truly disabled and that we have an accurate position fix. We still have to detect him. If his engine plant is down at minimums, hearing him will be nearly impossible, especially if he's up against the surface noise. If we go active, what's to stop him from launching a torpedo against us? If he does that, we can fire back and hope to survive ourselves. Our weapon might even hit him, but then again, it might not. If he does not shoot as soon as he hears our active sonar, maybe we can get close enough that we can intimidate him, force him down. We'll lose him again when he goes under the lair. But if we can force him down, and then stay atop the lair, blasting away with our active sonar, perhaps we can keep him from going to missile firing depth.
Dubinin frowned mightily.
Not an exceptionally brilliant plan, is it? If one of them suggested it,
he waved to the junior officers conning the ship,
I'd tear a strip off their young backs. But I don't see anything better. Do you?
Captain, that makes us exceedingly vulnerable to attack. The idea was more accurately described as suicidal, the Starpom thought, though he was sure Dubinin knew that.
Yes, it does. But if that is what is required to prevent this bastard from getting to firing depth, it is exactly what I propose to do. I see no alternative.
President Narmanov, please understand the position we are in. The weapon which destroyed Denver was of such a size and type as to make it very unlikely that this crime was committed by terrorists. Yet we have taken no action whatever to retaliate against anyone. Were your country attacked, you too would alert your strategic forces. We have similarly alerted ours, along with our conventional forces. For technical reasons, it was necessary to initiate a global alert instead of a more selective one. But at no time have I issued any instructions to commence offensive operations. Our actions to this point have been defensive only, and have shown considerable restraint. We have no evidence to suggest that your country has initiated action against our homeland, but we have been informed that your troops in Berlin have attacked ours, and have also attacked aircraft attempting to inspect the area. We are similarly informed that Soviet aircraft have approached an American carrier group in the Mediterranean. President Narmanov, I urge you to restrain your forces. If we can end the provocations, we can end this crisis. But I cannot tell my people not to defend themselves.
Restrain your forces? God damn it, the defense minister swore. We haven't done anything. He's accusing us of provoking him. His tanks have invaded East Berlin. His fighter bombers have attacked our forces there, and he just confirmed the fact that his carrier aircraft have attacked ours. And this arrogant madman now says that we must not provoke him. What does he expect us to do? Run away everywhere we see an American?
That might be the most prudent thing we can do, Golovko observed.
Run like a thief from a policeman? Defense asked sarcastically. You ask that we should do that?
I suggest it as a possibility to be considered. The first deputy chairman of KGB stood his ground bravely, Narmanov thought.
The important part of this message is the second sentence, the foreign minister pointed out. His analysis was all the more chilling for its matter-of-fact tone. They say that they do not believe this was a terrorist attack. Who is left as a likely attacker, then? He goes on to say that America has not yet retaliated against anyone yet. The subsequent statement that they have no evidence to suggest that we perpetrated this infamy is, I think, rather hollow when juxtaposed with the first paragraph. And running away will only make it more clear to him that we are the ones who started this, defense added.
More clear? Golovko asked.
I must agree with that, Narmanov said, looking up from his chair. I must assume now that Fowler is not rational. This communique is not well-reasoned. He is accusing us quite explicitly.
What of the nature of the explosion? Golovko asked the defense minister.
A weapon of that size is indeed too large for terrorists. Our studies indicate that a first or even second generation fission device might be achievable, but the maximum yield for such a device is certainly less than 100. Probably less than 40 kilotons. Our instruments tell us that this device was well over 100. That means a third-generation fission weapon, or more likely a multi-stage fusion device. To do that is not the work of amateurs.
So then, who could have done it? Narmanov asked.
Golovko looked over to his president.
I have no idea. We did uncover a possible DDR bomb project. They were producing plutonium, as you all know, but we have good reason to believe that the project never truly got underway. We've looked at ongoing projects in South America. They are not to this point either. Israel has such capabilities, but what reason would they have to do this? Attack their own guardian? If China were to do something like this, they would more likely attack us. We have the land and resources they need, and America has much more value to them as a trading partner than as an enemy. No. For this to be a project of a nation-state means that only one of a handful has the ability to do it, and the problems of operational security are virtually insurmountable. Andrei Ilyich, if you directed KGB to do this, we probably could not. The type of individual necessary for such a mission, by that I mean the skill, intelligence, dedication, are not qualities which you find in a psychotic. Murder on this scale, likely to bring about such a crisis as this, would require a diseased personality. KGB has no such people, for the obvious reason. So you are telling me that you have no information, and that you can find no sensible hypothesis to explain the events of this morning?
That is the case, Comrade President. I wish I could report something else, but I cannot.
What sort of advice is Fowler getting?
I don't know, Golovko admitted. Secretaries Talbot and Bunker are both dead. Both were watching the football match. Defense Secretary Bunker was the owner of one of the teams, in fact. The director of CIA is either still in Japan or on his way back from there. The deputy director is Ryan, correct?
That is true.
I know him. He is not a fool.
No, he is not. But he is also being dismissed. Fowler dislikes him. And we have learned that Ryan has been asked to resign. Therefore, I cannot say who is advising President Fowler, except for Elizabeth Elliot, the National Security Advisor, with whom our ambassador is not impressed. You tell me, then, that this weak, vain man is probably not getting good advice from anyone.